The Art of the Good Life: Clear Thinking for Business and a Better Life by Rolf Tobelli, the million-selling author of The Art of Thinking Clearly. Foreword. Since antiquity, in other words, for at least 2,500 years, but probably much longer, people have been asking themselves what it means to live a good life. How should I live? What constitutes a good life? What's the role of faith? What's the role of money? Is leading a good life a question of mindset, of adopting a particular attitude, or is it more about reaching concrete life goals? Is it better to actively seek happiness or to avoid unhappiness? Each generation poses these questions anew, and somehow the answers are always fundamentally disappointing. Why? Because we're constantly searching for a single principle, a single tenet, a single rule. Yet this holy grail of the good life doesn't exist. Over the past few decades, a silent revolution has taken place within various fields of thought. In science, politics, economics, medicine, and many other areas, scholars have come to realize that the world is far too complicated to summarize in one big idea or a handful of principles. We need a mental toolkit with a range of tools in order to understand the world, but we also need one for practical living. Over the past 200 years, we have created a world we no longer understand intuitively. This means that entrepreneurs, inventors, investors, managers, doctors, journalists, artists, scientists, politicians, and the people like you and I will inevitably stumble our way through life unless we have a sound box of mental tools and models to fall back on. You might also call this collection of methods and attitudes an operating system for life, but I prefer the old-fashioned toolkit metaphor. Either way, the point is that these tools are more important than factual knowledge. They are more important than money, more important than relationships, and more important than intelligence. A few years ago, I began assembling my own collection of mental tools designed to build a good life. In doing so, I drew on a wealth of half-forgotten tools from a classical antiquity, as well as on cutting-edge psychological research. You could even describe this book as a classical life philosophy for the 21st century. I've been using these tools in my daily life for years, and they've helped me cope with many challenges, great and small. Because my life has improved in almost every respect, my thinning hair and laughter lines have made me no less happy. I can recommend them to you with a clear conscience. These 52 intellectual tools may not guarantee you a good life, but they'll give you a fighting chance. Number 1. Mental accounting: how to turn a loss into a win. I should have known, shortly before the motorway exit in Bern, there's a gray speed camera that lies in wait for unwary drivers. It's been there for years. No idea what I was thinking. The flash jolted me out of the reverie, and a quick glance at the speedometer confirmed my fears. I was going at least 10 meters per hour too fast, and there was no other car far and wide. Nobody else I could pin the flash on. The next day in Zurich, I watched from a distance as a police officer tucked a ticket underneath the windscreen wiper of my car. Yes, I was parked illegally. The car park was full, and I was in a rush in finding a legal parking space in central Zurich, as like finding a deck chair in the Antarctic. For a moment, I considered running over. I pictured myself standing in front of the officer, gasping for breath, hair disheveled, trying to make him understand my dilemma. But I let it go. Years of experience have taught me that such things only make you feel silly. You look small and you end up losing sleep. Parking tickets used to infuriate me. These days I pay them with a smile. I just debit the sum from the account I've marked for donations. Each year, I set aside 10,000 francs for good causes, and I pay all my fines out of that. In the world of psychology, this simple trick is known as mental accounting. I borrowed it from Richard Taylor, one of the founding fathers of behavioral economics. Mental accounting is considered a classical logical fallacy. People treat money differently depending on where it's coming from. So if you find money on the street, you treat it more casually and spend it more quickly and more frivolously than the money you've actually earned. The parking ticket example illustrates how you can turn this logical fallacy to your advantage. You're deliberately tricking yourself for the sake of your own peace of mind. Say you're traveling in an impoverished country and your wallet disappears. Minutes later, you find it again. And all that's missing is the cash. Do you see this as theft or a donation to somebody who's probably far worse off than you are? No amount of mental gymnastics will alter the fact that your money was stolen. But the significance of what happened, the interpretation of the event, that you can influence. Living a good life has a lot to do with interpreting facts in a constructive way. I always mentally add 50% to prices in shops and restaurants. That's the amount of this pair of shoes or sole a lemonnière will actually cost me, taking income tax into account. If a glass of wine costs $10, I'll have to earn $15 in order to afford it. For me, that's good mental accounting because it helps me keep my expenditure in check. I prefer to pay for hotels in advance. That way, I won't spoil a romantic week in Paris by being confronted with the bill at the end. The Nobel laureate Daniel Kahneman calls this the peak end rule. You remember the high point and the end point of your holiday, but the rest is forgotten. We'll take a closer look at this effect in chapter 20. If the end of the trip is a big fat bill presented to you like marching orders by a snotty French receptionist and complete with his mysterious extras, he has probably added on purpose to punish you for not speaking accentless French, your memory of the romantic getaway will be forever tarnished. Pre-commitment, they call it in psychology, pay first, consume later. It's a form of mental accounting that takes this thing out of the payment. I pay taxes with equal nonchalance. After all, I can't upturn the taxation system single-handed. So I compare what I get in return for my money in the lovely city of Bern with cities like Kuwait, Riyadh, the jam-packed concrete wasteland of Monaco, or the surface of the moon, all places without income tax. Conclusion, I'd rather stay in Bern. People who move to ugly cities for tax reasons make themselves seem petty and stubborn. Not exactly solid bedrock for a good life. Interestingly, my transactions with such individuals have thus far all been bad. That money can't buy happiness as a truism. And I'd certainly advise you not to get worked into a lather over incremental differences in price. If a beer is $2 more expensive than usual or $2 cheaper, it elicits no emotional response in me whatsoever. I save my energy rather than my money. After all, the value of my stock portfolio fluctuates every minute by significantly more than $2, and if the Dow Jones fall by a thousandth of a percent, that doesn't faze me either. Try it for yourself. Come up with a similar number, a modest sum to which you're completely indifferent. Money you consider not so much money as white noise. You don't lose anything by adopting that attitude, and certainly not your inner poise. There was a period of around the time I turned 40 after a long spell of an atheist that I started doggedly trying to find God again. For several weeks, the obliging Benedictine monks and at Einsiedeln put me up as their guest. I have found memories of this time remote from the worldly hustle and bustle, no TV, no internet, and barely any phone signal thanks to the thick medieval walls. Most of all, I enjoyed the silence during the meals. The monks were forbidden from speaking. I may not have found God, but I did learn another mental accounting trick. This time, temporal rather than monetary. In the refectory, as they call the dining hall, the cutlery is placed in a small black casket about 8 inches long. At the beginning of the meal, you open the lid and extract the neatly bundled fork, spoon, and knife. The message? You're basically already dead, and everything that follows is a gift. Mental accounting at its best. It taught me to value my time, not to waste getting into a tizzy. You hate queuing at the supermarket till, waiting at the dentist, sitting in traffic jams on the motorway. Your blood pressure reaches 150 in seconds, and you start frantically releasing stress hormones. But instead of getting upset, consider the following. Without this unnecessary agitation eating away your body and soul, you live a whole year longer. That extra year would more than make up for all the time you spent in queues. The upshot, you can't nullify the loss of time and money, but you can reinterpret. Open your box of mental accounting tricks and see for yourself. The more practice you are at dodging fallacies, the more fun it is to occasionally commit one on purpose. Remember, it's for your own good. Chapter 3, The Fedge, Inflexibility as a Stratagem. In 1519, the Spanish conqueror Hernan Cortes reached the coast of Mexico from Cuba. He summarily declared Mexico a Spanish colony and himself the governor. Then destroyed his ship, eliminating any chance of return for himself and his men. From an economic perspective, Cortes' decision makes no sense. Why exclude the possibility of returning right from the square one? Why exclude alternatives? One of the most important principles of economics, after all, is that the more options you have, the better. So why did Cortes abandon his freedom of choice? 2 or 3 times a year, I meet the CEO of a major international corporation at various obligatory dinners to which we've both been invited. For years, I've found it striking that he always turned down dessert. Until recently, I considered his behavior illogical and ascetic. Why exclude the sweet option on principle? Why not decide on a case-by-case basis? Why not make this decision dependent on how much he weighs, how filling the main course was, or how tempting the dessert looks? A blanket refusal of pudding may be a less dramatic decision than barring your return home, but at first glance, they both seem unnecessary. One of the world's most important experts on management is Clayton Christensen, a Harvard professor known for his international bestseller, An Innovator's Dilemma. A committed Mormon, Christensen leads his life according to pledges, an old term for a promise one cannot break. If a pledge sounds too fusty, call it absolute commitment. I'm a fan of the older term because these days commitment is subject to inflation and often used insincerely. We are committed to improving the state of the world. Only an individual, not an organization, can make such a pledge. In his younger years, Christensen saw many managers sacrifice the first stage of their lives to their careers so that they could dedicate the second half, by now financially independent, to their families, only to discover that their families had either fallen apart or long since flown the coup. So Christensen made a pledge, promising God not to work at weekends and to eat dinner at home with his family on weeknights. Sometimes, this meant he'd get to work at 3 in the morning. When I first heard this, I found Christensen's behavior irrational, obstinate, and uneconomical. Why be so inflexible? Why not decide on a case-to-case basis? Sometimes you simply have to work on the weekend and then you can make it up by working a bit less on Monday or Tuesday. Flexibility is an asset, surely, especially with the time when everything is in flux. Today, I have a different perspective. When it comes to important issues, flexibility isn't an advantage. It's a trap. Cortez, the dessert of Verse CEO, and Clayton Christensen. What all of these three of them have in common is that they have radical inflexibility to reach long-term goals that would be unrealizable if their behavior were more flexible. How so? Two reasons. First, constantly having to make new decisions, situation by situation, saps your willpower. Decision fatigue is the technical term for this. A brain exhausted by decision-making will plump the most convenient option, which more often than not, is also the worst one. This is why pledges make so much sense. Once you've pledged something, you don't then have to weigh up the pros and cons each and every time you're faced with a decision. It's already been made for you, saving the mental energy. The second reason inflexibility is so valuable has to do with reputation. By being consistent on certain topics, you signal where you stand in established areas where there's no room for negotiation. You communicate self-mastery, making yourself less vulnerable to attack. Mutual deterrence during the Cold War were based largely on this effect. The USA and USSR both knew that the nuclear strike would mean instant retaliation. No deliberation, no situation weighing up of pros and cons. The decision for or against the red button had already been taken. Pressing it first simply wasn't an option. What applies to nations applies equally to you. You lead a life consistent with your pledges, whatever those look like, people would gradually start to leave you in peace. Legendary investor Warren Buffett, for example, refuses on principle to negotiate. If you want to sell him your company, you've got exactly one shot. You make precisely one offer. Buffett will either buy the company at the price you suggest, or he won't buy it at all. If it's too high, there's no point lowering it. A no is a no. And everybody realizes that. Buffet has acquired such a reputation for inflexibility that he's now guaranteed to be offered the best deal right from the world go, without wasting any time on haggling. Commitments, pledges, and unconditional principles, it sounds simple, but it's not. Say you're driving a truck full of dynamite down a ramrod straight, single-lane road. Another truck is coming towards you, so also loaded with dynamite. Who swerves first? You can convince the other driver that you've made the stronger commitment, you'll win. In other words, the other driver will serve first. I'm assuming it's acting nationally. If, for example, you can convince the other driver that your steering wheel is locked and you've thrown the key out of the window, you're signaling an extremely strong commitment. That's how strong, believable, and radical your pledges have to be in order for your signals to be effective. So say goodbye to the cult of flexibility. Flexibility makes you unhappy and tired, and it distracts you from your goals. Chain yourself to pledges. Uncompromisingly, it's easier to stick to your pledges 100% of the time rather than 99%.